From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. The University of Oregon is a real touchstone for our community. Like a small city within a city, the U of O is academic institution, economic driver, employer, and cultural mecca all rolled into one. It's no wonder that we assign a lot of media coverage to what's happening at and what's happening to the college. Today on the show, you'll hear from our news team about critical events happening at the U of O. Nathan Wilk will talk about a looming strike among faculty, as well as an update on a long-standing strike at one of the university's biggest vendors. And Sajina Sresta will talk about a major federal funding cut to a museum on campus. And we'll finish out the show giving you some last-minute tax tips from a financial expert. That's next on Oregon on the Record. There's a lot going on at Oregon's signature university, and right now, two big issues, a looming strike and federal cuts, are hanging over campus like a cloud. Our news team brings you the latest. KLCC reporters Sajina Sresta and Nathan Wilk, thank you both for coming in and chatting with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Michael.
It's kind of a... this is a news sandwich with the strike kind of creating the bread. So we're going to start with Nathan, who's been immersed in these pretty important strikes going on in our community. Nathan, let's start with this one, the one that's been going on for half a year. Mm-hmm. Give us an update on what's happening at Bigfoot.
Right. So Bigfoot Beverages workers there went on strike back in September. They want to keep their pension plan rather than transitioning to a 401k, and there's reasons for that in workers' eyes. They need to qualify for the Western Conference of Teamsters Pension Trust.
Okay.
But we're now 6 months in, and there has been no movement on either side, no further negotiations. Workers are still out there on the picket line. And when I speak to them, it is kind of at a standstill right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the things that could have been taken away were taken away, healthcare coverage. But workers on the line say they are being financially supported by Teamsters funds. At the same time, those workers I spoke to said that it seems like Bigfoot is still continuing to get business and contracts with local businesses continue able to operate. So moving forward, they're really waiting on the National Labor Relations Board to hear some of the unfair labor practice charge complaints from both the union and from the employer. One thing in particular to note here, Michael, is that the Bigfoot official stance is that the strike is already over. They believe that the union no longer exists. They no longer recognize it. And that's in Bigfoot's eyes on the basis that they received a petition from a majority of workers saying they no longer wanted to be represented by the union.
Hmm.
But it's worth noting that according to the National Labor Relations Board, a union can't be decertified just by a petition alone.
Hmm.
There also has to be a decertification vote with the entire bargaining unit, all the workers, and workers say that hasn't happened. And I've reached out to Bigfoot a couple times to try to get confirmation on that and haven't heard back in particular confirmation of whether or not that vote did happen.
Nathan, when you talk to the striking workers, I mean, do they give you a sense of how long they can hold out? You know, kind of what's the mood? What are they telling you about not only the logistics of why they're there, but also just, you know, are they fearful about how long this could go and its impact on their economic situation?
I mean, again, I think when I spoke to workers back in December about mm-hmm. loss of healthcare, that was a real concern, and it still is an economic issue that they're facing now. You know, the current benefits that they have, the option of having a COBRA that could go away later, that would be over a year later. So, you know, where they've been for a couple months is where they are now, and workers tell me they're doing okay.
Okay. My last question for you on this topic, Nathan, is I asked you about, you know, if the workers are going to be able to sort of hold out indefinitely on this side, what about the company? I know they're not really talking to you, and you talked about that they have contracts, but obviously they're a business. They're, you know, we're very used to seeing their trucks around town. They're a huge supplier to the University of Oregon. Kind of, can they keep going as long as they want?
That's also a good question, Michael. And I will say Bigfoot has spoken to me previously.
Okay.
They didn't answer those specific questions related to ongoing operations. But again, workers, when I spoke to them, seemed a little frustrated at seeing local businesses that were continuing to work with Bigfoot, saying that for some businesses they'd encountered, Bigfoot saying the strike was over was effective. That some local partners believe that or understand that to be the situation there, and that, you know, that may be reducing the efficacy of this strike on sort of diminishing business for Bigfoot.
Okay. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to our own reporters here at KLCC. We're talking to Nathan Wilk, and we're talking to Sajina Shrestha. And they're talking about the stories that they've done related to the UFO, the strike, the potential strike, as well as potential funding cuts. So, Gina, we're going to go to you now because you've been covering this story about sort of defunding and how it's impacting a local museum here on the University of Oregon campus. Talk about what your story was about that you just dropped earlier this week.
Right. So I believe recently President Trump had signed an order highlighting 7 independent federal agencies that he targeted as hoping to dismantle or cut down on. And one of them was IMLS, which is the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which provides grants and funding to libraries and museums all across the nation. And our museum here, Museum of Natural and Cultural History, actually receives quite a lot of funds from IMLS to do a lot of their projects. I believe in 2010, it was through a grant or funding by IMLS that they were able to expand. In 2021, they were able to do this project of rosters, this roster where Oregon Folk Life, I believe, if you had like something specific, like if you wanted someone with a specific folk art occupation or someone who's a master of it, you could go in there and you could find everything from, I believe, Native American bead workers to Rwandan embroidery artists to Andean musical artists who do musical instruments that you could then contact and bring back to your classroom or your event space.
Okay.
And then recently they also had this thing called traveling exhibits, which were 4 different exhibits. 2 of them were about, I believe, the Native innovations, and what on the other 2 were about dinosaur history in Oregon, which was actually something that helped the museum go from a stationary place in the University of Oregon to all over Oregon. So they would load up the van and they would go to different areas like Nissa, Sweet Home, Lincoln City, where they could set up in community centers or more specifically in libraries, and they could have people from the town come and visit and see these exhibits. And another thing that they actually provided was also bilingual Spanish-specific materials so that the library themselves did not have to provide costs for translating the materials, but actually the museum was able to provide these materials so that people could enjoy this exhibit in both English and Spanish.
You've talked to some of the people at the museum. What were some of the fears they expressed? If this funding is cut, you know, what might happen?
Right. I believe their biggest worry is that they're not going to be able to fund projects like the traveling exhibits, because I believe they don't just want to stay here in Eugene. I think they'd want to go out to different areas in Oregon, because I believe Todd Bragey, the executive director, what he said was that we're a state museum, he said, and that they want to provide for the state of Oregon based on what the Oregonians need. And he said that he's heard feedback that they want programs like this where it's not just people coming to Eugene, but the museum actually going to where people are. So that's one thing that he's worried about is how are we going to get to rural areas that might not have the resources to come to us in Eugene?
Yeah. And then in listening to your story and reading, there was this element that kind of caught my eye about this idea that there may be, you know, funding tied to this idea of a theme like patriotism or something like that. Can you expand upon that? Are they basically being told you can be a museum, but you got to be a museum for the way we want the theme to be expressed?
Right. So the new director, Keith Sunderling, I believe, when he was sworn in, and around that time, he released a statement where he said that he would direct IMLS more specifically towards patriotism and, I believe what he called it was generating love for nation in younger generations. Hmm. And what I heard was that people are worried what this could mean when it comes to what they can collect, what they can show as history. Because, I mean, if I'm being honest, I feel like you can't really show patriotism and then, I mean, I'm sorry, you can't really like feel patriotism if you're not for a country, if you're hiding stories. And I think this fear also might be coming from the attacks on DEI that the Trump administration has brought on, because a lot of the history isn't always, I just think a part of the statement said because to foster love, I think it is hard to do that if the history like shows themes of like manifest destiny or colonialism.
Yeah. I imagine you're going to be attuned to this because there are many organizations that are facing funding cuts. I didn't know in some of your research, did you hear, you know, from other organizations, or did you hear even some of the reading you've been doing about this almost this fraternity of organizations that are seeing their funding cut all over the place?
Well, yeah, I was looking into specifically updates in the situation, mm-hmm. and there was like similar reports, all like similar news stories all across like different areas. I saw articles coming from Baltimore, North Carolina, Michigan, which all kind of echoed the same worries of like it was either the libraries or the museums being like, hey, this institution funds a lot of our things. We don't know what's going to happen. We're bracing for this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're still kind of on U of O campus because we're going to switch gears a little bit and move off from the museum and talk about the campus writ large. Nathan, you've been following a very big topic, which is this this potential strike at the university with regard to faculty. Talk about where that's at.
Right. So U of O faculty had been bargaining, declared an impasse, or continuing to bargaining with the University of Oregon, you know, and they want higher pay, and they want paid career development. Mm. For faculty there, for professors and others that are covered under their unit, which I think is about 1,850 people, 1,850. Mm-hmm. They have now declared an intent to strike. Okay. That would begin on March 31st is a date that they proposed. You know, the effects that would have on the university and how exactly the university would respond, what classes would look like, is still a little bit unclear. Hmm. In my communications with them. This is something that is ongoing. The negotiations are ongoing. In fact, there was just an offer and a counteroffer from United Academics and from the University of Oregon that just came in. And you know, last year there was a graduate educator strike that almost happened and was averted just a few days before. The University of Oregon's stance that they've shared with me has been pretty consistent, which is that they value U of O faculty, that they want to give them a fair offer, but that they have financial constraints. Some of the budgetary issues and budgetary shortfall information that they've shared previously and KLCC has reported on. So that is their fairly consistent stance across communications that I've had with them.
And I understand, and I know that this is still kind of amorphous, but aren't there student workers that potentially could go out on strike as well coming into the near future?
Right. So that is kind of happening at the same time here. They have authorized a strike, which doesn't necessarily mean that they'll strike. They've okay. also declared an impasse. So, you know, that means that they're moving through the process. They're a little bit earlier than faculty are. So their strike would be mid to late April at the earliest. And, you know, they're also seeking higher wages especially some changes to how UO handles harassment and discrimination in the workplace. You know, the most recent conversation I had with them, they talked about really wanting to be able to have a third party in the grievance process when a case of harassment or discrimination happens at UO. And that really represents a lot of the underlying infrastructure at the University of Oregon. Speaking even just as a former UO student, mm-hmm. when you're walking around to dining halls, when you're walking to, you know, on-campus buildings, there are a ton of those students who are, you know, running the university and running some of the everyday action. So that would also be a huge effect if they were to go on strike. Now, what I'll say is that they have expressed that they have gotten some movement from the University of Oregon, but that, you know, after lots of bargaining, they feel like it's moving too slowly. And that's why they're pushing forward this authorization and this impasse and these options.
Okay. Challenging times currently and ahead for the University of Oregon. Really appreciate you both coming in. We've been talking with KLCC's reporter, Sajina Shrestha, and Nathan Wilk. Thank you both for coming in and covering these important stories.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for having us, Michael.
My next guest is a financial expert, and she joins us to provide some basic tips and counsel as tax day bears down on us all. Amy Butler, who is a certified financial planner and also senior wealth advisor for Focus Partners based in Eugene. Thanks for coming in and chatting with us.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
It's tax season. So, you know, generally speaking, what should people be doing right now to prepare their taxes?
That is a lovely question. Right now, if you have not completed your taxes, okay. I know many of your listeners probably have already.
Okay.
But those who have not really should get on collecting their data and their information.
Okay.
And what that looks like is things like W-2s or 1099s, maybe some interest forms, things like that. Other things that people should collect are things for deductions.
Okay.
So if you have medical expenses, I don't know, Michael, you may have had a couple of those recently.
Good point.
Yourself, so perhaps you should look at that. Medical deductions, things like mortgage interest, real estate taxes, those sort of things.
Okay. As life gets more complicated, especially as people get older and they have more things going on in their life, what's kind of a good general rule of thumb for when you might want to transition from preparing your own taxes? And I know there's a lot of great new tools available, but when you might want to transition from, okay, I'm going to do it myself to I'm going to bring in a professional to help me?
That is one question that I get a whole lot. And I will share with you first a quick story about when I decided it was time for me to get a professional. And that was way back when I got a letter from the IRS that said, hey, you did something wrong on your prior year tax return. So I think often people have a situation like that where you maybe mess something up a little bit and it is a trigger for you to find a professional to make sure that you're doing it correctly.
Okay.
Beyond that, I think when you are selling something, so if you're selling a house or a business, businesses in general, I think are a really good reason to use a professional tax preparer if you've got things like that that are going on. And lastly, you know, if there's a death in your situation, transition times are really good times to engage with a professional.
You bring up something interesting. You know, there's always that old cliche about, you know, a doctor shouldn't treat themselves. You're a professional, but you've used other professionals. Is that kind of a good idea? Because obviously, you know, when we personally look at our own finances, maybe we're going to miss something. And having that outside set of eyes might be a really good idea.
Yeah, my opinion is yes.
Okay.
You know, I have found over the years that there are plenty of things that I know and a lot of things I just don't do without the pressure pressure of having to be held accountable by someone else.
Okay.
And my CPA will tell you that I am just as bad as every other client in preparing my documents for him, always on the last day.
Okay. you know, obviously things happen in life, and maybe somebody isn't going to hit the well-known deadline of April 15th. You know, what should they do if they're just not going to make it? What do they do?
Yeah, that situation happens a lot.
Okay.
I think the first thing that people need to note is, even if you are unable to file on time, if you owe taxes or think you owe taxes, you're going to need to pay those.
Okay.
At least an estimate of what you expect them to be. But essentially, there's three ways. Hmm. So one way, you can go online, you can pay the estimated taxes and file an extension right there on the IRS website. The second way is to send in a form through the mail. And I have to look it up. Let's see. It's form 4868 is nice. The name of the form. I looked it up for you.
Thank you.
But that particular form you can mail in. And then the third way is to go into the IRS free file site, and you can file directly there for an extension.
Okay.
And that extension will give you time between now and October 15th.
Okay. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking with Amy Butler. She is a certified financial planner, and she's a senior wealth advisor with Focus Partners. And I imagine we could spend hours talking about this, but just generally speaking, are there kind of, you know, some of the biggest mistakes that people make when filing their taxes? Is there kind of like some of the classics that you've seen or you know, even experienced yourself?
Yeah. So we can go back to my experience there for a second and why I got that letter.
Yeah.
And that was that I missed putting in what the cost basis was of an investment that I had sold.
Oh, okay.
If you do that, the IRS assumes it's zero. and therefore, in my case, they thought I owed quite a bit of money. So I think it's really important that folks really make sure they put in proper cost basis.
Sure.
The second thing that people tend to forget is certain types of income. So remembering that you have, for instance, interest income. The last few years, interest has been a little higher on bank accounts, and lots of people are getting 1099s that maybe they haven't gotten in the past.
Mm.
So remembering that to add those things, I think, are the other parts. And then, you know, third, I think sometimes it's just clerical errors. When you're doing it yourself, sometimes you add things up improperly or put them in the wrong lines, and that will definitely cause some mistakes and get the IRS to touch base with you.
Sure. Amy Butler, thank you so much for your wisdom and counsel.
You're welcome. Happy tax season.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, Travel Lane County is working hard to make sure that the vast majority of venues and attractions in our region are accessible to all, and their leadership stops by to talk about their initiatives, and we'll head to the coast to hear how an organization is turning travel dollars into environmental sustainability. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.